Hello, welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with co-host Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking to Professor Tim Hansen, University of South Carolina from the Department of Statistics. Now, statistics, you know, there's lies, damn lies and statistics. Something like that, I remember somebody said. And we're going to be talking about a particular interest of Tim Hansen's, and that is with drug cisplatin. It's a platinum drug. And it's been used for very many different types of cancer, breast cancer, certainly esophageal cancer. And Tim's trying to look at the different ways to assess the efficacy of this particular drug, particularly treating children. Tim, after all that, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this and the efficacy of this drug, which is a very strong, potent drug, how did you get into this game? When you were a little kid, did you just think, numbers, I like numbers? Or was there some other reason?
I've always liked numbers. I've liked programming. I started programming at an early age. I remember when my dad got a TRS-80 color computer and I learned assembly language. And I was able to make graphs and games and things like that. And so I was always in some way quantitative. And the thing that really got me is in college, I really wanted to learn calculus. I felt like I kind of got it in high school, but I really wanted to learn it. And I had some excellent teachers. And it just the light went off, and I kind of knew I was a mathematician. Interest in lots of different things, music, playing a band. I thought I might go into physics at one point, lots of different things. But math was it, so I got a math degree. And that ultimately led to statistics indirectly. I thought I was going to get a PhD in mathematics, and I studied, and I took my qualifying exams, and I passed two out of the three at the PhD level. And the third one, which is my favorite subject, analysis, I only passed at the master's level. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to redo this. It was my favorite subject. Everyone said, don't do it. Don't take it. Don't take analysis. It's too hard. Take complex analysis. It's easier. And I did it. And I thought, well, you know, I did my absolute best. I think I could go back and do this. But I was taking some statistics courses at the time, and I was amazed at how easy and how fun statistics was. You could apply these simple, crude models immediately to data and get answers. To get a PhD in mathematics, you study things that have been done since the 1700s. redo them and work your way up into the 20th century, now the 21st century. It's a lot harder. I don't want to say that statistics is easy because it's not.
Well, it's easy for you.
It was easy for me, and I think that it's easier to distill data into answers quickly, and that's what a lot of what we do, and especially now in this age of we have absolutely enormous data sets, we need answers more quickly. We're having to analyze data sets that are just monumentally huge. But that spark was when I was a graduate student and I was taking my statistics courses, an introductory and measure theory, both from the same Russian mathematician.
Where did you study?
New Mexico, University of New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
I was in the math department.
Well, welcome home.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I used to drive down to Juarez.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And statistically, was that successful?
Sure. I mean, for what we were, yes. We'll just leave it at yes.
Well, let me ask you a question about your experience, you know, where this was always something when you were very young that you were turned on to. How do you translate that to students, young students who want to become STEM? We recently did an interview with somebody that said they can't become interested in science if they're watching the Xbox all the time.
Okay. Well, I was always into – that's a great question. I was always into games. The difference is I wanted to make games. And you can – if your child is into this kind of thing, but they also have, you know, like an interest in lots of things, there's now programs that you can go on the internet. I forget what these are.
Xboxes for one.
Well, the Xbox, these are like all – it'd be hard to start off as an Xbox programmer. You can make simple games on any web browser in a computer language. There's these simple computer languages. They're kind of like Logo was the one that when I was a kid that people could use. And kids could write in Logo. Basic is another one that people can still use. But they have more sophisticated languages that you can go on any browser and make a simple game where you're shooting at aliens or you're, you know, two dinosaurs are wrestling, things like that. And that would get a child who was interested in games also interested in maybe creating or making or doing something artistic.
That's a very interesting point. So, in fact, with the prevalence of all these games, do you find more and more younger people becoming better at getting into statistics, mathematics, programming? Or is it just a story that for those few who get turned on by that aspect as opposed to just playing?
Wow. I would say most of the people that go into statistics are foreign. They're foreign students. We don't have a lot of domestic students that go into statistics. And so I don't actually know how to answer that.
Well, but everyone's playing games. So, I mean, it's not translating into an interest in how is that game actually formulated.
I would have to say that most of the people I've known just have that interest.
Okay.
And they've always had the interest of how things work or wanting to make things or whatever. Yeah.
Statistics, I said at the beginning, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics. So it doesn't necessarily have a good reputation because statistics leads to some interesting answers and responses.
Arguments on Fox about who's winning the election.
For example, right. So, you know, you can use statistics for all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I mean, traffic flow, income, outcome of economic systems, et cetera, et cetera. But you've chosen a very specific, at least one of the things that you have chosen, is this sort of efficacy of a particular drug. Tell us, how did that decision come from, you know, what you just described as the background and your interest in getting into statistics?
That was one of many things I've worked on in the last 15 years. I've been a professor since 2000. And they usually come about in the same way. Someone has some data that they've collected or they're about to collect, and that's the best scenario if they come to you before they collect the data and ask you, how might we collect this data? You know, but a lot of times we're approached, people just have – they've collected the data and they want to answer
and
questions.
They just throw this bunch of data at you and say, go.
Well, I got a phone call 3 years ago from a friend of mine from when I was a graduate student at New Mexico. He was an anthropologist, and he ended up working for the VA in Portland. And they do a lot of things for vets, but the entire population that have to do with hearing damage, assessing hearing damage, preventing it, things that happen as you get older with your hearing. And they collect lots of interesting data. And it's interesting data because a lot of times they'll collect information on the same person over time. They might put someone in the middle of a room and they'll have tones come from different points of the room, like in a circle, and that person has to kind of point and figure out where the tone came from. It has to do with perception. And so anyway, 3 years ago, this person, Garnett McMillan, who I've worked on a lot of papers with over the years, called, and he had some data that I thought was pretty interesting. It had to do with cisplatin, which is a chemotherapy drug, and it's used for all kinds of cancers, as you said. And one of the problems with cisplatin is that it causes ototoxicity, inner ear poisoning. And so what happens with some children, well, 70% of children that use this drug, that have children with cancer, have permanent hearing loss. And this kind of thing, when you're developing as a child, can have very detrimental effects in terms of balance, learning. All kinds of things can happen. So what they wanted to do is they want to be able to know if the cisplatin is damaging the hearing. And if it is, they can try other drugs. They can alter the course of therapy. They can use other modes to treat the cancer as well, especially if the hearing damage is becoming very pronounced. Okay. So there's different ways of assessing this damage, and some of them are hard to implement with very young kids. It's hard to give an infant a hearing test. And what they have is this DPOAE testing, which basically they put a microphone, they put a little insert in a child's ear, and it sends a tone into the ear canal, and then it reverberates and comes back out, and it's recorded. It's really easy to administer. The child doesn't have to be able to speak or anything like that.
So it's a Doppler?
It's kind of like that. I mean, it sends something down and then it receives it back. That's right.
Okay.
This data, so they put this insert into the ear, and what they get is they get a curve for each ear. So you can think of a function. It's a function of frequency. They send different frequencies into the ear, and they get what's theoretically a smooth curve. So in the studio, I'm using my hand to make a smooth curve, mm-hmm. like a sine wave or something like that. And that measures a particular ear's response. And everyone's ear is different. Everyone's ears are going to have different curves, okay? What you really want to get at is whether or not that curve is changing in time over the course of the treatment with cisplatin. If it's changing a lot, then you have ear damage. So they have this really easily administered test to figure out if these kids are losing their hearing, okay? And what they wanted was reference standards, okay? So they wanted a reference chart. They get a curve, and I'm making the curve again. They want to have maybe a lower bound and an upper bound that this curve should fall into. And more importantly, what they want to do is, let's say that a child starts the cisplatin treatment at baseline. They want to measure that child again a month later, get a different curve, and see if that curve is different in some way. So what they approached me wanting was some sort of a chart that they could look at. They look at the difference in the two curves, and if it falls within a certain range, the child's okay, normal, healthy. So that's what they wanted, and that's what I did. And so I used some kind of sophisticated cutting edge, at least for us, statistical techniques. I used something called hierarchical Gaussian processes to give them the chart. And I did this in conjunction with one of my PhD students.
So this is a chart for each frequency? Or
all the frequencies at once.
Okay.
It's a curve.
Yeah,
yes,
right. So you can take each frequency and take all the different curves, take the number, and get some response with time.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
A difference curve.
Yeah.
Over, and they go basically from 1,000 to 10,000 hertz, okay, 1 to 10 kilohertz is what they look at. That's what they wanted, and we were able to deliver that, and we did a nice job with that. But where my little wrinkle comes in is that I was thinking about this with my graduate student. You can have a set of normal ranges, okay, and you can still have curves that are strange that fall within there. So, for example, you could have a set of normal ranges, an upper and a lower bound, but you could have a difference curve that's highly oscillatory, okay? It's all over the place, crazy. And that would mean that the curve at baseline and the curve 1 month later were very different. They were crisscrossing all over the place. And so what we also did is we came up with an overall summary of how bizarre or weird the curve is, okay? And another a common measure for this is called a p-value. So p-value is the bread and butter of statistics, right? T-tests, p-values, that kind of thing. Well, we have to have something.
Freakishness.
Yeah, freakishness. How freaky is the data that I saw? Exactly. And it's a little bit harder to do that when you have a curve. We have to figure out how unusual that curve is, but we figured out something to answer that. It'd be kind of hard to explain, but it's called a contour probability, and it gets at how bizarre the curves are. So now we have both a set of reference standards, and we also have one measure of whether or not that kid's in trouble. And it turns out that it works really well. It can detect kids that fall within these reference this chart that we made, but there's still something really unusual going on with the cochlea, with the ear canal.
From your experience, is any of the impact reversible? That is subsequent, so this is permanent. Long-term damage.
Yeah. Which is why it's so important to figure out early if it's happening. And you can change, there's lots of different cancer treatments
now. Well, do you follow the kids after they've stopped to see if something changes?
The people that collected the data might do that, yeah, or that designed this study would do this. And, I'm a statistician, so we look at the data and we provide – yes, you should. You should follow the child.
So maybe we don't know the answer to that question right now.
I think they've studied this a long time, and a lot of the hearing loss is permanent. That's a statistic I know, is that 70% of kids, it's permanent.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and we're talking with Tim Hansen, a professor from the Department of Statistics, University of South Carolina. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, and Tim Hansen from the Department of Statistics at the University of South Carolina. And we were talking about the utility of statistics to analyze loss of hearing functionality for young people being treated with cisplatin. And it's a serious problem because the damage is apparently irreversible.
Yes.
So once you've got to that conclusion and you can start to see during the drug treatment, during the therapy, that some of these patients are getting deleterious impact on their hearing, mm-hmm. Is there a methodology that says maybe we should go to a different drug design?
Yes, we try different drugs, different modalities. And then I'm not the expert in this. And so what I'm hoping happens is I think that we're going to get the paper accepted at a good journal. It's a statistics journal. Now, the person I'm working with at the Portland VA said something about me coming there to give a talk because he was really interested in these contour probabilities, this measure of how abnormal this test-retest difference is. And so what I'm hoping is I'll give a talk, and then the people there that deal directly with gathering the data and writing up the more subject-orientated kinds of articles will get this information out, and it will be implemented. And that would be a success on the part of statistics. At the very least, we get the idea out there that you shouldn't just look at normal ranges. When you're talking about functions, you're talking about height at a certain age. That's fine. You know, if you're in the 99th percentile or the 50th percentile or whatever. But when you're talking about a trajectory over time, it's a little bit harder to say what's normal and what's not normal. And that was the fun. That was the interesting part. And as a statistician, I give a few talks, we publish the paper, and that's where I'm kind of done. And we hope it catches on. And some things catch on and some things don't. But this one seems important enough that even if it doesn't catch on with the audiologists and the people that are treating these children, it could be used someplace else.
So what's next?
What's next for me is I back out. I've done my part. I hope for the best. I don't get into a lot of arguments.
So then go backwards. What other projects have you done?
Lots of stuff. The main thing I've been working on over the last 5 years is spatial data. We have data that's collected over space and time, spatiotemporal data. And again, I've looked at cancer, cancer survival. A big one is breast cancer, and how that's how geography impacts that. And of course, geography, if you're looking at states like Texas or South Carolina or Minnesota or Iowa, a lot of times geography is a proxy for other things, money. Okay, and people, if you live in a county that has a lot more money and a lot more access to service, you're going to live longer, things like that. We found things like the amount of ruralness can impact how long people survive, things like that. But initially, looking at spatial patterns in survival incidents, things like that. I've done a lot of work on that. Yeah, and I'm unusual in that I'll look at anyone's data. I was once called by the chair of I was in the biostat department at Minnesota, a really good department, for a number of years, and the chair there called me a statistical whore because I would work on anything.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy it. That's how you learn. Yeah. Well, you talk to scientists in other disciplines, see what they're working on, see what the problems are, and see if you can help.
You know, we have quite a few geologists here who are plotting data from underneath to tell whether you got an oil well or not.
Yeah.
And that looks to me like it would be a moneymaker statistic area to be in.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of areas like that.
This is 98%. That's 2%.
Yeah. Probably the money that could have been made has been made by now. But, yeah, that sports statistics is another place where you can make a lot of money. Anyone that can predict the stock market, of course, is going to make tons of money.
Well, I mean, let's go to that because that implies – I mean, it's one thing to talk about medicine, loss of hearing, drug dose, time of, you know, being administered the drug. It's and you can look forward in that. You can look into the future. Mm-hmm. But you think that the stock market is something that statistics really does help you understand better?
No.
Simply because of the past, you can think you can predict the future? I mean, I'm not sure I get that.
There's a million models out there, stochastic models,
time
series models.
How about the price of silver, which we hear about 24 hours a day?
Yeah. And the reason is there's too many lurking variables. There's too many things we can't measure that we don't understand that's driving this stuff. Worldwide, local, fluctuations, and all kinds of things.
When you think of a lurking variable, I think of somebody sort of being tricky or dishonest.
Well, that's because – well, there's something called – I think it's spurious causation. You can find all kinds of crazy correlations out there, and they're driven – they're driven by things that are actually something else that's lurking underneath, changes in diet over time, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit to this drug therapy and its impact. Is cisplatin the only – drug where you can get this particular impact on hearing? Or is, I mean, you'd think that maybe you got onto something and there may be things that are happening. Aspirin, for God's sake. I know when I first started taking aspirin, I was playing tennis and I did something to my ankle. And my doctor said, oh, go away and stuff yourself full of aspirin. You know, this will be okay, and then get off it. So from that day on, my ears have never stopped ringing.
Really?
Right? Yeah. I mean, I just took so much. I got buzz, and that buzz has gotten more pronounced. I mean, I just wonder if this test could be used for things that we don't quite recognize.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and I hadn't thought of that. Probably the manufacturers of this technology are trying to find all the possible uses for it. I'm sure it's not just with cisplatin, but I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
Also, I came into play after the data were collected that had to do with finding these normative ranges.
Right.
But yeah, sure, this could be used. Anytime there's damage to the ear canal, it's going to change. If the physical structure could change, and that's going to change these DPOAE admissions.
There's also studies that say if you're taking aspirin a day, you'll never get cancer.
Never get cancer or a heart attack?
Well, the cancer in particular.
Really?
Well, I tell you, my doctor, a very well-known local coronary fellow, he said, I told him I'm taking an aspirin a day. I did since I turned 50. And he said, why? I said, well, I just read like Russell did, something in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, right? An aspirin a day is good for you. He said, that is just so wrong. He said, if you don't have any symptoms of having an issue with high blood pressure or some coronary feature, don't take it. It's more dangerous than just waiting around. It's not necessarily so good. And in fact, that's a good statistical test right there. Aspirin thins the blood. It's obviously used as something as a blood thinner. But that can cause issues of ulcers. It can cause when you cut yourself, it will bleed.
Sure.
He said there are too many negatives associated just to be taking it as a therapeutic when you don't need a therapeutic.
Does your doctor have any statistics to go along with it?
Well, that's what I'm just talking to Tim about. I mean, you know.
Well, one of the classes I teach, we talk about a study that had to do with aspirin. In fact, it was performed on physicians. But they were they had some sort of incident, coronary incident. That was the study population. And in the population where they had some heart problems, the aspirin really made a difference.
Exactly. So if there's a reason, that's fine. But if you're just a normally healthy guy who reaches 50 or 60, there's no reason to suddenly get onto a baby aspirin every day.
Yeah.
Be more deleterious.
Yeah.
You know, to me, and this is my own interest, there's this cultural heritage issue. For years, 2,000 years maybe, people around this region have been taking creosote tea to prevent kidney stones.
Uh-huh.
And there are two questions. First of all, we did science and published it and said, it works on kidney stones. But the other question is, how the heck did they figure that out? And over 2,000 years, is there really evidence for that?
You have to run a clinical trial. So that's how we answer these things in the 21st century, right? Is you run a clinical trial.
You don't think a 2,000-year-old clinical trial was enough?
Well, there's lurking variables. Okay, so maybe this has to do with the genetic makeup of the people that were originally in this area, the Native Americans.
It didn't work for me. I had a kidney stone 20-odd years ago. I took this disgusting tea, governador, and it tasted foul. It did me no good. And then I discovered that there's something called laser tripsy, and that was beautiful. It took me 7 hours in hospital, I felt perfect.
Yeah, but it was for prevention, not cure.
Well, no, they told me to take it, and it would slowly, you know, go away. Anyway, our time has gone away, I think, right? So, Tim, I was going to call you Tim Horton. Do you know Tim Horton's the
donuts in Canada?
Yeah, right, exactly, all those good donut shops. Well, we've come to the end of our time, and so Tim Hansen from the University of South Carolina, Department of Statistics, a lot of fun. You're a good, easy-talking mathematician and statistician.
Yeah.
So we thank you for being here on Science Studio.
Yes, thanks a lot, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio, and we'll talk about something completely different.